This is John Stepling, and this is Aesthetic Resistance, and this is podcast 27. This time I'm pretty sure of the number, 27. And with me in New York is Hiroyuki Hamada, and with me in Toronto is Corey Morningstar. So, hi, guys.
Hi, John.
Hey,
Corey.
Hi, good morning.
I'm
not in Toronto, John. I'm outside of Toronto.
I'm
close.
Yeah, I'm in Indre, Norway, which is you probably have a hard time finding it on a map of Norway.
Yeah.
But we're in a kind of wetlands reserve here. It's very nice.
Sounds beautiful.
So there's very few houses, very few people, which suits me just fine these days.
And I'm in there.
We were all talking earlier, and I was on a thread earlier on Twitter with Corey and with Molly Klein, who wasn't able to do this particular podcast, but I hope she'll be back. About propaganda and about the way in which the sort of the Great Reset and the COVID lockdowns in particular, and that have just decimated societies. I mean, I read the other day, 62% of American small businesses are going under. That's the definition of just a gutted society. I mean, that's an extraordinary number. But I see on social media all the time, and I never know entirely because I also read mainstream media and all the usual things. I'm never entirely sure, how accurate what I stumble across really is, or if I'm creating this distorted picture or something. But my sense is that what I see, the way in which these people will come on with opinions about, say, the Great Reset or the Green New Deal or climate change, whatever it is, but especially the Great Reset. And they will talk about, it's communism. We don't want communism. Or and they have no idea what communism is. They really don't have any idea what fascism is, because that word gets turned around. They don't even have for themselves a working definition of these terms. But I was thinking how one of the most popular sort of structural devices in this propaganda, one of the most popular is to conflate socialism and communism. But to somehow make everything all the same. Oh, well, it's totalitarian. You see, it's communist, it's socialist, it's fascist, it's capitalist. And these are all the same anyway, because there's a secret cabal of Jewish bankers or something that control, the world. And it struck me that this kind of very reductive and simplistic thinking is another expression of exchange value. It's that law of equivalence, in which one thing is the same as another thing. They are balanced out somehow. And of course, part of this is because nobody has any class analysis. That's been erased from everything. People will talk about Marxism as if they know something about it, but never mention class. It's very interesting. But I think it feels that kind of equivalency, this false equivalency, but this kind of constructed equivalency feels familiar to people, and it's a source of comfort in a sense to people. So that explanation feels like something they know about and understand, and it, as I say, it's familiar, and so they embrace it. Where if you actually had to explain what capitalism does and what surplus value is or whatever, and the nature of markets and on and on and on, and the way money works, it's much less familiar. It's hugely unfamiliar, in fact. And so it is, I, because I, my experience is I will see people or hear people tune out. They just will shut down. They don't want to talk any further because it is suddenly into a realm that feels acutely uncomfortable. And just, I'll throw this over to you too. But the other thing that, that sort of intersects here sideways, as it were, is this idea of fact checkers. Because somebody sent me a Snopes thing the other day about the sterilization of vaccines that caused sterilization in Kenya. And Snopes said, oh no, that's false. And I thought, well, of course they said that, but why? This is a really smart guy I know that sent me this, very, very sharp guy. And he's a psychotherapist and you know, very literate, and yet, you know, there he is resorting to Snopes. And that's that strange need for a reductive, simplistic declaration from a source that identifies as authority and feels somehow scientific, right? Because that equivalency always in some sense carries like the residue or baggage of scientific legitimacy. Anyway, all right, let me just throw that out to you guys, if you have any thoughts.
Well, go ahead, Haruyuki.
Well,
the fire.
I don't know. I feel like, you know, I keep saying the same thing over and over. It just comes down to the fact that we have authoritarian structure, and the very nature of the authoritarian structure is that the rules are unconditional. You know, there's no flexibility to the rules, and the rules are putting up those frameworks that define what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. So when the conversation reach those places, people sense that, and people either get upset because they are internalizing the system within their identity. They get personal. You know, they get upset. They are angry, and also they get, they are at the tough spot because then there's no answer to it because it's unconditional. You know, right. That you just can't say no. When if you say no, you're going to be excluded. You're going to be, you're going to be the witch. So,
well, it's also that, you know, the same thing that comes out of that when people will say, oh, well, but what are you going to do about it? You know,
right.
What are you gonna do about it? All this analysis, but what are you going to do about it? Like, as if it's my job to have a solution to, you know, the world historical record or something. I don't know, you know, apparently nothing, because I don't have very much power. But I do what I can, you know, I've seen people say that to you, Corey, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't know anybody who has turned out a larger volume of really significant essential stuff than you have over the last few years. Just the sheer volume of it. And yet people, you know, people will dismiss it because somehow there's not, it's almost like because there's nothing to sell, you know?
That's how I felt about the mass. I felt like the social distancing wasn't adequate because there was nothing to sell. So when the mass came, it could be consumed.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then there was this huge uptake because it was like the pink bracelet on the hand, right? The pink ribbon or whatever that is to show you're a good citizen, right? Or the red poppy. Right. And that mask could be consumed. And then it went very, very quickly to hold of the whole populace. The whole thing about the capitalism being conflated with, or World Economic Forum being conflated with socialism and communism, it's just sort of breathtaking. And I see this as very problematic because they love this, right? They love this. People thinking this way. And I think it's important that we get the framing right, because framing and language are so important. And that's, you know, how they actually win almost everything, because they seize that framing and language. They know how to frame it for the public. They know how to tell the story, right? So much of this is marketing, even the Great Reset. So much of this is marketing, stakeholder capitalism, storytelling, marketing, right? Believe us, right? We've got your back. It's that. And so I've been thinking a lot. I was listening to Molly Klein yesterday, to all her podcasts or whatever they are on YouTube, and really trying to knock out, you know, what this is going forward, because I think we need to define it before they do. I think it's important. I think it's worthwhile. And so that's what I've been thinking about, even in my sleep, trying to figure out how to, you know, really concisely and easily, so it's easily understood, so people can get it, you know, what this is going forward. Because yesterday, even I went back, because I remembered that the Hewlett-Packard Foundation, I had read this paper on neoliberalism where they, I mean, this is one thing about them. You're able to find a lot of information because their egos are so big, they can't help but brag about their accomplishments. And so Hewlett-Packard, the president, wrote a paper on and how the foundations were responsible for the creation and nurturing and fostering of neoliberalism, right? Not even the governments, the foundations. No. So they drove it. And so now the very same players, same foundations are saying, okay, we're done with neoliberalism now. They've just invested $50 million. And then they don't name who they are exactly, but they say they're working with academics and thinkers, right? The special people around the world to define what we'll have going forward. And then they say, well, you know, we know that we're the ones that created that awful system before, but now you can trust us going forward. Now we're going to create something really great.
Right.
And I was just thinking, it's like the stakeholder capitalism thing where, you know, I was thinking how if you're a battered woman, a battered spouse, an abused woman, abused spouse, you go to your psychologist or your, you know, counselor, a group, and you tell them, you know, you're abused, you're emotionally, physically abused by this person. They don't go when, you know, and you tell them all the manipulation, right? All the mind manipulation, you know, can call it Stockholm syndrome, but you don't go in one day with a new letter, right? That they wrote, like this stakeholder capitalism, and they won't say to you, well, let me read the letter, and then say, you know what, this letter is amazing. Go back. They really mean it this time. They don't say that. They say, this letter is bullshit. Look at how you've been treated in the past. Get the fuck out of there before they kill you. Right. And so this whole idea that now these very same people that, you know, don't have any qualms about killing hundreds of thousands of women, men, children to, you know, seize the resources in countries that they destabilize, occupy. Like, we're supposed to believe these people care about the environment going forward, care about us going forward. Now we're being made into, stakeholders of the system, you know?
Well, excuse me. I mean, I think that as soon as anything is for sale, there's an element of corruption that can't be avoided. You know, I remember back in the sort of early 70s, I was living in California, but between California and New York, and there was a wave of self-help stuff, right? It was the time of Est and all these various gurus cropped up, and there were a lot of them, but they all charged money, right? They all talked about this was, I'm sharing this truth with you, but they were exactly not sharing anything with anybody. They were charging people, and I used to ask that question, but if this is, you know, if you, guru, believe this will make the world better, make people happier, why are you not sharing it for free? And of course, there was never any answer. And what's amazing, of course, is that nobody found that strange at all. So, again, this comes back to the fact that there's no class analysis in any of this stuff. Americans in particular, by and large, don't believe class exists. And perhaps there are chunks of the population that increasingly are it's dawning on a lot of them that, you know, there are haves and have nots, but the nature of that relationship remains very mysterious, and that's what has to be articulated, and that, yeah, you're right, we have to find me and the mouse in my pocket, we have to find a language that defines very specifically, because the propaganda is just pouring in all the time, and it's extraordinarily confusing. And there's not just a lot of it. There's a lot of it, some of which makes a little bit of sense, some of it which makes no sense. And there's always a kind of scapegoating mechanism involved too. But years ago, Adorno said this thing about kitsch biographies, that Americans loved these kind of kitsch bios of people, that's what's substituted for really, a deeper analysis or researching of what somebody has done and said and produced. And that's what you get now. People will click like or not like, and they want to know if whoever the person is, if they like them personally or not. And people rely on this sort of strange kitsch emotion, their own kitsch emotions to decide these things. Oh, Kamala Harris, I loved her expressions when she was debating with Mike Pence. You know, I think she's going to be okay. And it's that level of I don't know, manipulation, emotional manipulation, which is very, very base. I mean, it's very rudimentary, and yet that, you know, it's a lot of how people end up choosing their opinions. Opinions are like shopping. I've said that before, but I don't know. It's the lack of understanding about how capital, the very idea that capitalism is exploitive at its core. This is something that most people don't accept. I mean, a large number of Americans, at least, or Westerners. The default setting is that the government doesn't lie to us intentionally, except for a few bad apples, and that basically people want good things to happen, and basically capitalism is the only thing that has ever made any sense. And, you know, we certainly don't want communism, and on and on and on. I don't know. It's disturbing to me. And I know last time I commented about my personal angst, and you said, yes, because we're being reprogrammed. And I thought, well, and that's very true. But this touches on something else, and I'll just throw this out too. Because a lot of people who do great research and are really, really good, Alison McDowell is one of them. I mean, she's an amazing researcher. And I sometimes am frustrated because I feel her conclusions are confused, as it were, confused conclusions. And it's a little bit of a problem, and it's like, but it's really complex material. And so, you know, as I say, I'm a fan of hers, and I quote her a number. I've quoted her a number of times, but it's very difficult. It's difficult because this is a huge topic that requires, you know, extensive analysis, and I don't know what one does with the fact that, it's almost too much for anybody to really know. And it's a full-time job, you know, it's a full-time job, as you know, Court. So.
Well, I think adding on to that, you mentioned a couple times there about facts, and I think you even used the word emotion. And all the PR firms, the public relations agencies, marketing, that all these corporations, they funnel billions of dollars through the foundations, and then that all goes to the NGOs. I mean, all of this is driven by marketing, advertising, polls. Right. It's all of this is an extension of this is an apparatus of capitalism. And they know full well, and I don't know if we discussed this before, but everything is based the scientific fact. They know that people are driven, the decisions they make, the things they believe are based on emotion, not on facts. Right. And so everything is how to make people, how to seize that, how to manipulate that emotion. Right. So it's not based on logic or facts, anything. It's how to exploit and manipulate emotion in the populace to get what you want. I mean, that's what they say, to harness that energy, to get what you want, right? That's Jeremy Hyman's words. And that's, the Bible, basically. Now going forward, Richard Branson, World Economic Forum, right? Harness, this is what Black Lives Matter is, harnessing that energy to quote unquote, get what you want, right? So now they back those movements, they get in there, they create those, otherwise you'd never hear about them, the media would ignore them, and then they harness that energy to get what they want. And, you've got now the whole purpose working with UN, Nike, all the biggest corporations in the world, that's a major thing. The Black Lives Matter is like the new corporate anthem, for going forward. They're the new stakeholders, right? And what I've noticed in my research over the last month is right at the forefront of everything now for whether it's any kind of paper, document, any kind of website, right at the forefront is a black face, right? It's like, look at us. We finally get it. We're on board, right? We're not racist. So now that's their place. Now they're a stakeholder. There's your face. And now we're going to use you to further exploit you to further, right?
I saw an ad for the from Pfizer about the vaccine, the coming vaccine. And it was just absolute, Madison Avenue manipulation. The first subject getting a shot was a black woman, but one of the nurses was black. And so it was okay. And there was an Asian doctor, and I guess that was all meant to be reassuring as well somehow. But there was a montage, and there were, very emotional cuts to close-ups and smiling faces. And it was scored with very friendly, life-affirming music, it was a well-researched marketing campaign put into motion, and that's what it was. But see, this is what stands in place of debate. There is no debate. This, I keep coming back to this because I find it so breathtaking that there has literally, in terms of the COVID and the vaccine and the lockdowns, absolutely no debate whatsoever. And I saw the other day that Ivanka Trump said, oh, the lockdowns are not based on science. I thought, well, you just set back, skepticism about this stuff by a couple of years with that one remark, because it's cheer the hero and hiss the villain, and the Trump family are villains. And so anything they say, people are going to reflexively take the opposite position. And we're all familiar with, the sort of pejorative labels, conspiracy theorist or truther. This is the one that gets me too. Speaking of Molly, she pointed out it's like this pathologizing of truth. What's wrong with being somebody who's after the truth? But I guess you shouldn't be, because you can just go to Snopes and get the truth. It's everything's a menu. Everything is a drop-down menu from which you select, you know, the most frequently asked question. And it's people are increasingly reluctant to express a dissenting opinion about pretty much anything, I think, or certainly large numbers of people are. On the other hand, of course, there are massive protests around the world against the lockdowns. Even in the US, there have been marches, and is zero coverage in the media. Absolutely, absolutely no coverage at all, zero. And you, if what you do is watch mainstream media, you would have no idea of the hundreds of thousands of people that are refusing the pseudoscience of lockdown mask wearing and all of this stuff.
Yeah, and even that's framed as like you know, Nazis or Trumpites or whatever, the, you know, whatever. It's all framed as, oh, if you go out, if you're against the lockdowns or have, you know, question anything about the mainstream narrative, then you're shamed, isolated, right? You're right wing, right? Yeah. So yeah, and now we're nurturing and moving into like a snitching, shaming culture, right? Like more than ever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that it's a culture, a snitch culture already, and it's intensified greatly. But I remember that idea of being an informer, a snitch, tattletale, whatever. I remember that being, oh, maybe 25 years ago, reintroduced and normalized, where before that had been a bad thing. I remember distinctly seeing signs that that was changing, that, you know, if you see something, say something.
And oh, right. I forget. Yeah, yeah.
After
9/11.
Right. And people like that. But see, this comes back to my original point. People are very familiar with certain structural, as Hiroyuki said, frames. You know, there's certain familiar frames that are structural in nature, and it doesn't matter what the content is. I remember, I'm digressing all over the place. I worked for a while on a comedy show as a staff writer. This is a jillion years ago. It didn't last long because I wasn't funny. But anyway, and the lead guy who was really funny said, you know, it's just all rhythm. Two is tragedy and three is funny. And you could tell certain jokes in a sitcom in Greek or in Chinese and people will laugh, because they're anticipating the rhythm of the joke comes in threes. Guys walks into a bar, da-da-da. Second guy walks into a bar, da-da-da. If the joke ends there, it's tragic. But the third guy walks into the bar, that's the punchline. People know that, they anticipate that, and they laugh. Well, the same thing exists in the way these arguments are laid out and the scapegoating that is very familiar to people. And the being an informer is now part of virtue signaling, that, you know, you have to wear your mask. I see it in Hollywood. I see it in this year's opening episodes of a lot of TV shows. There's a lot of people, characters walking up to other characters telling them, you must wear your mask. And I see children in all of these shows wearing their mask. Why the fuck are children wearing masks? You know, well, because they're being trained from an early age, I guess. But anyway, and it goes back. I mean, I've written about this, but it goes back to, if you read all the Frankfurt School Adorno and Horkheimer and all the people and that emigrated out of Germany and some that didn't. All their writing on anti-Semitism is hugely relevant today because they analyze the structure of the way in which the ruling class weaponizes that scapegoating impulse and the us and them, the other, and you know, it's now, you know, with a virus, which is the most diabolical of enemies, I guess, in a sense, you know, if you look at it mythically or something, I don't know. Hiroyuki, what do you think?
I feel like I'm talking. One thing, you know, going back to the basic about capitalism, I think people seem to associate capitalism with exploitation. I think people get that. You know, people understand that you're being cheated. You know, somebody's making more money than you do, and there are tricks. And but the bulk of the trick that separates, that makes it more superior than slavery or colonialism, is that capitalism can transform our atmosphere. It creates culture, it creates social structure, and in which people are forced to operate in. So certain things has certain values. Like you were talking about Trump. If you talk about Trump, you will be ashamed. You know, there's a price to that kind of act. And mask wearing, you know, there's a price to that. And the layers and layers and layers of all those things create society, creates what's good and what's wrong. And this is the core essence of what we are experiencing. And this is the thing being erased. You can't talk about this. If you talk about this, you're a conspiracy theorist. So we need to be able to say it. And this is a structural thing, you know, that really, that's inhumane. You know, it's a domestication.
Yeah. This Corey and I were talking before we began recording, before you joined, you know, a little bit about, I don't know, the nature of, well, I don't, maybe Corey, why don't you, I want to, before, I'm going to try to avoid not digressing again. I wanted to talk about the great reset piece that you had, because this touches on some of what we've already gone over here today, but the way in which there is this image, this representation of technological genius or something, artificial intelligence, and how great it is, and people are hugely seduced by this. AI is going to solve all your problems, and a little bit about blockchain and all of this, because not everybody has read this, and I think it's useful to go back and fill that in before I launch into another digression here.
I don't know. It's sort of like industrial livestock, where they put the slaughterhouses out in the country and there's no windows and no one can see what's going on in there and no one wants to see, right? So they go to the grocery store and they buy their meat, and it's like, you know, full of cruelty and pumped with hormones and antibiotics, but it's sold as, you know, it looks fresh and good or whatever, but you don't see what's behind it. And that's what the fourth industrial revolution is, in a way. It's people perceive it, right? Even the names, the cloud, right? Even Amazon, all these things. It's like the suburban houses, how they're all named after, all these subdivisions are named after what they destroy, right? Birchwoods or whatever, Fox Trails, right? All the stuff we killed to make this, that's what we're going to call it. Yeah. And so that the whole idea of this clean digital world going forward, in actuality, it's just going to make aviation look like nothing. It's highly destructive, highly polluting, massive greenhouse gas emissions, right, from these data centers. So it's, but you don't see it, right? It's so we don't have to confront it. We'll just pretend it's green. You know, carbon capture, storage, nuclear, these are all things in the white papers, Amazon, Google, Microsoft. This is what's going to run data centers in the future. You know, all the renewable energy being created, it's not clean, but even if it was, we're creating energy for data centers. It's they're buying it all up, right? So yeah, I write about this, but it's, you can't see it, right?
Right.
It's made invisible. So you can tell a story, and if the story is good and people like it, that's, you know, people love stories. It's part of, and then I know, sort of like you bouncing around a little bit, I just had the notification.
It's impossible not to.
Because
everything is connected to everything else, and there are these overlapping branches and arteries of.
Yeah, and so the Great Reset, like going back, yes, I was just going back, yes, last night on doing research, going back to 2010, 2012, going through basically the history of the World Economic Forum, and going back to when they start talking about a required reset, there's a lot of talk about and they use the term the hollowing out of the middle class. Right? The hollowing out of the middle class coming from automation, right? And this goes back, this starts, 2016, 2017. This is not, again, like these things don't happen overnight. There's massive planning involved in this. And they have, you know, thousands, they have foundations, they've literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of NGOs, think tanks to carry out their work, right? There's no limitation to there. I mean, it's unlimited. The money spent on all of this to secure, protect, and expand their system, right?
Right.
I know I'm going all over the place here. Well, I wanted,
you know what? But what we talked about right before coming on the air was this feeling, and I talked about it last time, and this angst, this feeling of dread or ennui or whatever it is that I think a lot of us are experiencing. And it's connected to the tiny losses that happen every day that by themselves are not noticeable, but that accrue and have now reached threshold, experiential threshold, where you do feel them in their totality, that something is missing. And that's kind of related to how so much is taking place that we don't see, that's unseeable in a sense, right? I'm reminded that the turn of the, like from the 19th to the 20th century, was this age of psychoanalysis and optical discoveries, and it was also the birth of the detective novel. And I've said this before, I probably said it on more than one podcast even, but it was suddenly that there was an unseen world that is influencing people. So the detective was looking for clues that were not visible with the naked eye necessarily. Sometimes it was reason, sometimes it was his magnifying glass, whatever it was. And so now we have a kind of 21st century version of that taking place on some level, but it's all very accelerated and happening at a pace that makes it very difficult to keep track of for oneself, I think. Anyway,
well,
I just...
and people don't want to see it.
Yeah.
So, right, that's a big part of it. And they know that, they understand that. And again, exploit that. They know people don't want to see it. They don't want to confront it. People that have, you know, that benefit greatly from the system.
No, people don't. And I have a feeling that if you took entertainment, whether it was Hollywood or wherever you found it, and music videos and television and film, and you took the stuff that has been produced, manufactured over the last 2 years, and compared it to stuff from 20 years ago, and compared that in turn to stuff from, I don't know, 50 years ago, you would see dramatic changes in this kind of generalized autism. That was Bohr's term, but a kind of loss of affect. There's a deadness even to entertainment today. And I think that's part of what fuels the popularity of certain kinds of sci-fi, where everybody's in a mask and you can't see faces. The Mandalorian is an enormous hit, right? It's a reboot of some Star Trek thing. I lasted 20 minutes and it's just execrable and unwatchable. But the lead character who's in every scene has a helmet on and you can't see his face.
I've never heard of that show.
He's like a Star Trek or
Star Wars
bounty hunter, right?
Right, right.
But he never takes off his mask. I mean, I find this fascinating.
Mm.
You know, your protagonist is face.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask, sorry, I hope I didn't interrupt you. I wanted to ask Hiroyuki. I just saw on my screen, because we're going into, in Ontario, we're going into gray zone on Monday. So it's like super lockdown. It's the highest level. And I just saw a message that London, England just went down into emergency lockdown. So I'm assuming this is happening everywhere, that this is taking place. And I see this as a huge experiment over the holiday. I mean, the World Economic Forum said months ago that this is the biggest experiment ever undertaken on the global population. That's right on their website. And they know, right, that this is causing massive upheaval, massive mental anguish, physical harm to women, children, you know, mental harm. So this, over the Christmas holiday, this is the first Christmas, they'll be studying this, right? Looking at this to see what the fallout is, right? Mm-hmm. So I just wondered what was happening where Hiroyuki is on that level.
I mean, my area, like anybody else, I really feel isolated. I rely on information through online. I talk to people in the community a little bit, but opinions are varied to a certain extent, but people do accept the basic premise of what's going on. And so I would think that if something nefarious is coming, people are pretty defenseless. People are taking it. People welcoming vaccine. People welcoming lockdown in many forms. But there are people who are saying things. I came across something. Parents are getting together to oppose some form of school doing lockdown in certain ways. When I talk to people I know around, have small chat, some of them do express anger, frustration, and questions certain things. And I would throw, you know, some of the aspects of virus, some of the aspects of vaccine, and they do seem to understand. And so it's some people do understand, but it's a lot of it is structural. You just can't oppose it. Like, you know, you can't go to work. If you have certain attitude, you know, if you don't wear a mask, you can't buy stuff. So,
Hiroyuki, for example, next week, so starting Monday, there's no more than 5 people allowed in a home. So that means Christmas, for example, I'd have to pick and choose out of my children who's allowed to come and visit me and who can't, right? So what do I do? Pack a picnic lunch and go meet them at Costco? Because, I mean, it's okay, right? It's okay, I guess, to be there, but not in your home with your with your children.
So we had Thanksgiving break. We're told that you can't have a gathering of more than 10 people.
Okay.
And people followed, I think. Yeah, it's but 5 people, that's like I mean you know, that's pretty extreme. It's really provoking the people.
Well, it's, you know, that means it's not an accident that this is 2 weeks before now, a week before Christmas.
No.
You know, and that's the experiment. Can we kill Christmas, you know? And this is the biggest retail week of the year. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting elements in this, but I think there are two tiers to the experiment, in a sense. I mean, there's one, will people gather in groups of more than 5? And I think there's a lot of people that will. There's a lot of people that will. And the second one is, regardless of whether you are a COVID truther or a COVID denialist, whichever camp you're in, the experiment is also to track how much this has affected you. What is the cost? What's the emotional, psychological cost from resisting and from complying? Because there's a cost to both of them, right? And I think that's what people are going to pay attention to, because I mean, the one thing that has failed in this government narrative is they keep yammering away about, you know, this deadly virus, and they keep counting and all these numbers, there's new cases. They don't talk about the sick, and they rarely talk about the dead and whatever. But it's all, the fear mongering is acute. And, you know, as somebody said, but people are dying. And I said, you know, yes, people always die. And the question is how many, and how many from this kind of phantom virus that nobody seems to be able to define very well. But the thing that has failed in the propaganda is there aren't enough dead bodies. You know, they need 10 dead bodies down Main Street, rotting in the sun, for people to really become afraid, I think. And they haven't, there are no, you know, then it's the Walking Dead, then it's the bubonic plague. And then this certain sort of sense of reality will set in. But I, you know, I don't know if that's an intentional too, because maybe this is, you know, this is another way to reinforce the unseen. You know, it's in hospital wards that are overrun, and people are, you know, which hospital, where, because I'd like to see it, because I can never find these overrun hospitals. I don't know, but I know that the narrative unravels a bit, because there just aren't enough fatalities. And they can't seem to manufacture a number high enough to frighten people in the way that I suspect they want to. But I don't know. See, and I start sounding like an absolute tinfoil conspiracy. I mean, I hear myself. You know? but there,
that's the thing,
clearly, 50 million jobs lost, 62% of small businesses going bankrupt is not based on a medical reality. That I can say for sure, right?
Right.
This pandemic does not justify those economic actions, those authoritarian, anti-democratic, you know, non-debated actions. That has nothing to do with medicine. That I'm sure of. Beyond that, I don't think I'm sure of anything, frankly, but I have my suspicions. Anyway.
Well, and they're predicting, they have since this started, actually in early spring, they've been saying the whole time, expect famines from COVID throughout the global South. I forget how many millions of additional deaths they foresee due to COVID, but it's actually not due to COVID. It's due to the lockdowns and the draconian measures. So, you know, again, like always, why don't those deaths matter?
Right.
You know, that's why Omali Yeshitela calls this the white man's virus, because it's a virus that can affect white people. So now it matters, right. You know, the other deaths apparently don't matter.
I was just on press TV 2 days ago talking about Yemen, because there was a new report came out about the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, which of course the U.S. trained the Saudi pilots, helped them with targeting, armed the entire Saudi military for this genocidal assault on the poorest country in the Arab world. And now the numbers of children, I mean, one bombing raid killed 20 children, Yemeni children. And the complete numbers are actually not known at this point, but it's something like, I don't know what percentage, an obscenely high percentage of the country is food insecure. There's cholera outbreaks all the time, all the diseases of insanitation, whether it's dysentery or dengue or whatever it is, are rife everywhere. And yet, you know, this causes barely a ripple in people. And their country, the UK and the US, are directly responsible for this and for supporting a barbaric, absolute lunatic monarch, because he sits on a lot of oil, you know. Well, and it's not just that, of course. He plays a structural role too. And my conclusion that day was, you know, Netanyahu visited bin Salman with Mike Pompeo. They all had a visit at some coastal city in Saudi Arabia to sign an agreement, along with the defense minister of the Emirates. And I said, what has become clear is that these monarchies and the Israeli state, and by extension, the United States government, the UK government, NATO, the EU, these are the enemies of the common Arab, the Arab working class. They are the enemy every bit as much as, you know, anybody you can think of historically. I mean, those monarchies are absolute enemies and are bent on, you know, the annihilation of their populations, essentially. And we're starting to see that now. I mean, Yemen is a perfect case. There's absolutely no medical. There's absolutely no military reason to bomb Yemen, right? None, zero. And there's nothing to bomb anymore anyway, but they keep bombing it. They bombed schools, they bombed hospitals, they bombed water purification plants. They bombed everything, the entire infrastructure. And now they're bombing it a second time because they've run out of anything else to bomb. It's no fun bombing the sand, I guess. And yet again, this is mostly invisible to Western consciousness, that is more concerned with, I don't know, how cute Kamala Harris was in her debate with Mike Pence, non-debate. I mean, the whole thing is just kabuki. It's just so bizarre and sickening at this point. I don't know.
It is sickening.
But I think that you're right. This Christmas is going to be very interesting.
Another thing happening too, John and Hiroyuki, while everyone's hysterical over the virus, is what's his name, Gordon Brown and Larry Summers are leading this, you know, quote unquote debt relief for 40 countries that have been, you know, further propelled into crisis, financial crisis by the COVID. Again, not accidental, like as the whole economy contracts, right? A massive corporate coup. So they're talking now about debt relief for 40 countries in the global south. Probably, I don't know them off by hand, but I think they're mostly in Africa. And they'll be, you know, they're talking about debt for climate, debt for sustainability swaps tied into the SDGs, which are the emerging markets. This will be a way, another coup of the commons, right? More ways to seize land and resources. So yeah, just another thing happening, right? That no one's even seeing or paying attention to.
Well, I mean, that transference of wealth that began, I suppose, really under Reagan, but accelerated acutely in the 80s and then under Obama, is almost complete. I mean, a very few people own most of the world, and now they're kind of, you know, tidying up their house, the planet, by getting rid of unwanted people. I mean, that's what it feels like. So, you know, it's hard to articulate a lot of this without sounding, you know, barking mad, but we do know that, that something is going to have to, you can't lose 62% of jobs in America. You can't have 50 million people out of work. That's a conservative estimate. The unbelievable numbers of homeless and families that, you know, are living on the street in tents or under freeway overpasses. It's everywhere. It is everywhere. And they do their best, the media does its best to limit visibility of these things. But at some point, that's impossible because it's virtually on every single street in cities like Los Angeles. And,
can I read yes. Two things out of a World Economic Forum report book? It's like 400 pages, and then maybe Hiroyuki can comment on that. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Okay, let me read them. They're just short. So this is 2017. From the book, we are at a point where it is possible that technological development can accelerate and increase digital refugees. And then within the same paragraph, it goes on to say, each country will have to set out its action plan to prepare for the wrenching transformations of the fourth industrial revolution. Right. So much of this is tied into the loss of jobs and throwing people into dire poverty.
Right. Well, I mean, they've had various experiments, emergency plan experiments. You saw it with the Boston Marathon, you know, can we shut down a whole city? Will people go along with it? You saw it certainly after Hurricane Katrina. And they rounded people up, shot many of them, sent them off to FEMA camps in other states, stole their property wholesale, just absolute naked theft. You've seen what the U.S. has done to Haiti. And so they have some idea, the government has some idea what to do with this what they see as a disposable population, certainly. I don't think it's a stretch at all to imagine people sent to FEMA camps that will be called something else, of course, right? Transitional housing development. It will be people in refugee camps within their own country, essentially, and they will be fed some kind of Soylent Green thing, God only knows, the same shit people get in prison. Remember, the prison population is 2 million now and growing. So They know what to do. The only growth industry left is prison construction, and these are the things they talk about with each other. You know,
these are the things they're doing. I mean, that one of the biggest refugee camps in Jordan, they're calling that now a permanent city, a smart city. And they're right. And they've already they use IrisGuard for payments. They're already testing all these things. It's called what's it called? Building Blocks. It's the World Health Organization partnered with I think MasterCard, Gates. It's already happening and been happening.
Right.
We just, again, like, no one's paying attention. We're not hearing about it. So, not covered very much. Okay. So smart refugee cities type thing for the future, perhaps. All packaged as, you know, caring, you know, equitable, right? That, you know, people care about you. They care about your health.
Oh, right? God, it's frightening. Well, I mean, actually, Molly and I were talking the other day about, because one of the recurring themes that pops up is the cashless society, right? And that was trotted out as part of the COVID policy too, that, oh, money is dirty. Well, but not in the way you think it is. So we'll have a cashless society. People will be issued a kind of temporary or expiring food stamp, or household item stamp chit that they can turn in at an approved site for a very limited selection of products. That's what's coming. I don't think that's unlikely in the least, actually.
Yeah, because that's full force coercion. Okay, so, oh, you need your whatever, your assistance check. Oh, well, you know, I'm really sorry, but we can't give that to you unless you have your digital ID or your digital wallet. And by the way, did you know that that contract, that smart contract, includes you need to be updated with your vaccination? Oh, you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. That's your choice. But unfortunately, there's nothing we can do if you don't have it. We can't give you your check to feed your children, right? That type of thing.
Right. Well, you know, they started that, the precursor to that, the early version of that, was that you had to have a smartphone, right? Landlines were being done away with, so that if you went online to register for anything, to buy a book, to have some t-shirts mailed to you, whatever it was, you'd fill it out, first name, last name, address, telephone number. You weren't allowed to say, I don't have a telephone. That was the end of it. You were stopped right there. You have to have a telephone. You can't get a bank account without a telephone. Why? I don't know, but you can't. So that was introduced 25 years ago, and it was coercive then. I mean, you can't do anything. You can't function in Western society without certain things, without a phone, and then without a bank account, and then you can't rent an apartment without a history, a credit history. So you're not allowed to go disappear or exist in an alternate homestead or space or something. You are not allowed, because when you try to return, you will be stopped. You will not be allowed to return. Anyway, did you have a second thing to read?
Oh, no, yeah. I read them both.
That was so fun. I like being read to.
I'll find something next time.
Okay. I don't know. I have a certain dread about this Christmas, I must say. You know, it just, there's so much, because I look at my kids who are really young and they love Christmas, and so far it's been fun for them. But there's still a ton of things that even 2 years ago would happen. There's a Christmas market in Trondheim. Well, not this year. You know, there's a reduced one, but you have to wear a mask. And none of the families are getting together. They're staying by themselves at home. So there's no social interaction. They'll get to see their grandparents, but that's about it. And I think this is the first COVID Christmas, and there's more to come at you know, the next smart camp that we're all assigned to. And I feel fortunate because I'm in Norway, and there's nothing but space here, thankfully. It's one of the most sparsely populated countries in Europe. And in fact, only 2% of land is cultivated in Norway. Same in Sweden, actually, which is pretty remarkable when you compare it to the US and stuff. Anyway, I don't know. What are you doing for Christmas, Hiroyuki?
Well, we usually do gathering at my wife's mother's place, but we will have a hard time doing any of the traditional things because mm-hmm. of the situation. And so I don't really know. It's a really it makes me think, you know, like there's one thing that this thing is exacerbating what's been going on. But at the same time, it looks like you guys are right that this is an experiment. And it is a good opportunity to gauge how big the cage should be and what kind of shape should it be. And we're giving out information, clues, how to be domesticated. We will scream and shout, we will talk about it, but if we don't have the cohesive view of the whole thing, we will be part of the experiment. We're giving out crucial information for the establishment to determine the kind of prisons we're going to be in.
Well, it's pretty breathtaking that this happened so fast. We talked about that last time, and I've had this sort of shadow following me around because I kept thinking this is just never going to ever return to anything remotely normal, and all of the things I still wanted to do and people to see and move about and meet with and have theater do other is never going to happen. Now it's almost becoming rote survival, you know, to stave off madness. What did Arto say? Slavery or madness? We shall see. Corey, where are you gonna be at Christmas?
I'll do whatever I like. We just have dinner. We don't do anything else. We just have dinner and get together. Yeah. But I mean, they'll be watching, right? Most years, I think that's one day people will turn off their computers and they will put their phones away and they spend it with their families. And they'll be watching how many people that day, instead of doing that, are willing to embrace, you know, the digital world, the virtual world. Again, they're watching us like lab rats. They study every move. You can see all these reports. McKinsey comes out constantly with, how things are moving, and they're stunned at their success. I mean, what they've wanted over years is happening in months, even in weeks.
With very little difficulty. Happening in months instead of years, with little difficulty. We'll see what happens if these protests grow. There's clearly a lot of people that have reached a point of nothing to lose. And there is desperation everywhere. So
that's actually a big part of this as well. They recognize that when people have nothing to lose, they will revolt. That they can be, that it's funny, you know, like you said before, John, Hiroyuki, you've said before, we've talked about this, I think, in communications online. how people can foresee the end of the planet before they can foresee the end of capitalism, right? The end of this system destroying us. They can't imagine it. But the funny thing is, the irony is, the ruling class can imagine it and they're terrified of it, right? So whereas we can't see it, they certainly see it and they are very afraid. And where we see many people feel we have no power, they fear our power, right? So a lot of this, again, storytelling, trying to get another, we need a new, you know, that word, a new social contract. It's storytelling. They need our social license to continue to operate, to continue to plunder, to continue to contract the economy, to, you know, further their control, right? Create this huge global digital prison. And, you know, over Christmas, you know that there's going to be, right now in Canada, the opioid crisis is going through the roof, right? Overdoses, deaths, right? How about those deaths? How about there's so much talk. I mean, from the people that work in mental health, this is a mental health crisis, right? Yeah. Children are suffering. The suicides over the coming week will be unprecedented.
I would imagine.
We can expect that. They know, they expect it. They don't care. They want to study it. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the other aspect to that, because that's really a good observation. And I mean, I read something the other day, even in Norway, here, the suicide rate has spiked and things are not so dire here again, you know, although it's still soul draining, the whole experience. But these smart cities, this idea of this sort of technological future, which many critics, I've said this before, but many critics of these, of blockchains and the fourth industrial revolution and so forth, while critical, still believe in the infallibility of this technology. And that's something that needs to be addressed at a certain point. Computers and AI are extraordinarily good at rapid computational, you know, processing. That's what they do. They're not conscious. They don't do anything else that's like sci-fi or futuristic in that sense. And it's important to understand that things like facial recognition still don't work, and are racially biased on top of it. But so much of the technology doesn't work. And the further you get into the periphery, the more damaged and incomplete and fallible is this technology. It works great, you know, in the showroom, and it works great at Apple headquarters or wherever it is, or Elon Musk's office and showroom. Everything looks great and works great, and military employs a lot of it, and even some of that works pretty good, some doesn't. But by the time it's used further and further away from the metropole, as it were, the less and less effective and efficient that technology is. It's not infallible. It's not transforming life. I mean, the internet has transformed life in some ways profoundly, but I'm still of the opinion in other ways it hasn't, and that often too much is made of the transformational aspects of that technology. That's why I think Guy Debord is still so absolutely relevant, because I think he understood that from a very clear kind of Marxist perspective, and that's important to remember somehow, I think, although I'm not sure I could articulate why I think it's important.
I think that's sort of related to the fact that people are so subservient to the idea of the system somehow working, you know, like the anomalies here and there, but the basic structure is working for them. And that subserviency is manifesting in opiate crisis as well, I think. People buy into the system, the idea of things are working, but they are not. They don't fit in.
That's a great point, man.
They have to destroy themselves instead of the system.
Exactly. Yeah, like Hiroyuki, the cage analogy. Okay, do they have to put us into the cage, or can they make us walk into the cage on our own, and we will shut the door behind us when we're in the cage?
Well, just treat everyday world like it was a cage. Yeah, exactly. You know, and nobody ever, I mean, I remember when soldiers returned from Vietnam addicted to heroin, and everybody was talking about, we have to disrupt the supply chain from, you know, the Golden Triangle to New York, blah, 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 and the French Connection. Nobody asked why so many soldiers were in pain.
Right.
Nobody ever asked that. And they're still not asking that question about any of this. Domestic abuse, ODs, psychological malfunctioning, depression, crippling depression, which has spiked also across the U.S. It's going to be an interesting, it's going to be an interesting holidays. Okay, guys, I'm going to let you, you know, run off and finish your holiday shopping. But let's do one after Christmas. I want a Christmas report from everybody. That'll be interesting. We'll see what happens. I think it's going to be, I think that Corey is quite right. This is the Christmas experiment, and it's going to be fascinating to track it. So anything else? Final thoughts?
I just wanted to say that it is possible to live without a smartphone. I don't have one. I never have. I never will. And you can do it. And it's possible.
I hate my smartphone. But I'll tell you something, because my wife always laughs about this.
Okay.
The only calls I get on my smartphone are from her. Literally. You know, there's like 600 calls, and not, I think, somebody at the chess club called me once or something. And I don't call anybody. I occasionally one or two calls in a year. I simply have it as identification. I don't even know how to use my phone. I take pictures with it, but that's it.
Yeah, I get it.
I don't like it. And it creeps me out.
It just feels like enslavement, all this stuff. Absolutely. It's just, right?
And it's scary.
It's my computer.
Yeah, how quickly children can use it, master the skills of smartphone and touchscreen and stuff. Terrifying to me. You know, I don't want them anywhere near it, but that's impossible. So,
well, all the best to both of you, and thanks for having me. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Goodbye to both
of you. Thank you.
Guys. We'll talk soon.
Okay, bye, Hiroyuki. Bye, John.
Bye-bye, Corey. Bye. John. Bye. Bye.